Lawrence Berggren is a historian and author of several books, including most recently a biography of Francis Drake, In Search of a Kingdom. This is Lawrence Berggren. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right, I'm here with Lawrence Berggren. Thank you very much for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here.
So you've written a number of books about a lot of different famous explorers, some of them more controversial than others. But among some of your subjects, I actually wanted to start with Magellan and his mission to circumnavigate the globe, because I think in a lot of ways his psychology is sort of typifies the psychology of these different explorers. So first off, most ordinary people in his day, putting this in context, when they think of sailing around the globe for months at a time with the outcome, your survival, uncertain, most people would not be interested in doing that, I would assume. Why did Magellan want to try it?
Well, that's a good question, and the two parts. People didn't want to do it because they thought it was impossible. They were unsure about whether there was a general consensus that the Earth was round, but you know they weren't sure what that meant. Maybe it went off into clouds, what they call brumae. Maybe you could sail off the edge of the Earth somehow, or even if it was round, there were sea monsters. There were islands that were magnetic that could pull the nails out of a ship, and then it would fall apart, and various other hazards that Magellan disproved, but were considered to be at least a 50-50 chance of being real. But he wanted to go for a specific reason, and that was to get valuable spices from Indonesia, from the Spice Islands, and at that point, spices were even more valuable than gold. Well, why was that? Because they were rare. They were needed not only for flavoring food and preserving dead bodies. They were like a form of currency all on their own. Keep in mind, there really wasn't much paper currency, if any, in the West at that time. They were fairly light and transportable. And the old-fashioned way of doing it, which I wrote about in my other book about Marco Polo, was that people made a long, many year long trek across what that was hazardous, going east across to Asia, and getting them and bringing them back, on cart and on foot to the West. By that time, they were rather dry and worn out, and they were not in great shape. That was the old-fashioned way, and that's what Marco Polo and his family were doing. Magellan thought he could do a shortcut, and he could sail over water. He could reach the east by going west, and he could do it in a matter of months or weeks. Well, why did he think it was so easy? And he wasn't worried about sea monsters or anything. He was a very experienced, confident, and tough captain. He thought it was so easy because he did not know about the Pacific Ocean. And as we know, it's the largest body of water on the planet. If he had known that he would have had to cross the Pacific in order to get to the Spice Islands, on top of everything else, he probably wouldn't have gone. Nobody would have tried it, but he didn't know about it. So, in a sense, ignorance was bliss. It took the survivors of this mission, to give away the ending. He was killed in the Philippines in a needless military conflict. 3 years to do it. He thought he could do it in a matter of months, there and back, because he had a distorted idea of what the Earth was like. Interestingly, the Greeks, using mathematical measurements, had a better idea of the actual size of the globe, but that was forgotten knowledge. A lot of knowledge from antiquity was lost, and some of this mathematical and geometry knowledge was lost as well. So, with a series of false assumptions, he started out on this circumnavigation, which was much more of an adventure than he ever had imagined it would be.
So, he did not even live to see the end of this journey and complete the circumnavigation. I mean, that must have been a huge disappointment, no?
No, that was not the goal. I think he, that was sort of an incidental thing, but he did not. He wanted to go get spices, especially cloves, which were the most valuable from the Spice Islands. And the circumnavigation part was incidental.
And of course, he did not just decide to do this on his own. He got backing in this endeavor, correct? How did he do that?
Well, he, a little bit of history here. He was a skillful and accomplished Portuguese pilot. And he had also been a soldier. He had been wounded in a battle. He limped. And he spent 7 years trying to get backing from Portugal, which this is like a little bit like a space race, only instead of Russia and America, you had the Portugal and Spain. He spent 7 years trying to get backing from King Manuel on a expedition like this. And, you know, it was on the verge of getting it, but he could never quite get it. Finally, he gave up and he did what other mariners did. He went to Spain. Because King Charles in Spain was backing voyages. So this also was complicated for him because he became a Portuguese captain on a ship that had many of the officers were Spanish and therefore rivals and not really inclined to listen to him or trust him. And the crew was from all over the place. It was a regular UN of a crew. They did not, in a way that was good, it was bad. They did not have a common language. They didn't really communicate very well with each other. And many of them were convicts or, if they hadn't actually been on the ship, would have been in jail. So they many of them came from the dregs of society. There were some crew members who had special talents. They were gunners. There was a barber who also doubled as a surgeon, and there was a cook and things like that. But mostly they were a pretty rough and ready crowd. So it was a very difficult undertaking just to ride herd on this. It turned out to be a fleet, and he because he had several ships. And that was, but he was able to get the backing from King Charles, which is really what mattered. And, you know, what King Charles wanted was the spices. They were, believe it or not, considered to be worth as much or more than gold. In fact, often he passed up the opportunity to load up one or more of his ships with some gold when they came across it or were able to steal it from another ship. And they passed it by because he wanted to save space for spices. I know it sounds incredible, but it's true. And so those were some of the, I don't know, peculiar traits of his expedition. He also, fortunately for history, a chronicler with him named Antonio Pigafetta, who was a papal legate or diplomat. And Pigafetta wrote an account in French. Well, the French of that time, we would call it now Middle French or Old French, but it was French. That was the kind of language of the intelligentsia at that point. And since he was Venetian, it was a kind of Venetian French about the experience. And the great thing was there were some specialized sailors' diaries that talk about the wind and the water and the waves and the compass and all that stuff. But Pigafetta gives you a sense of what it was actually like to sail with Magellan, you know, to stand on the deck, to face the dangers, the battles, the orgies, which he was not prudish at all in writing about. So he was one of the few survivors of this, and he wrote a book called First Voyage Around the World. And that's really our best document of, you know, what it was like in a kind of subjective way from a, you know, a layperson's perspective. Magellan had some diaries and papers, but they were all lost. They all wound up at the bottom of the ocean. So unfortunately, there's very little that survives in his own words.
You know, I was reading some of your descriptions of Magellan as a leader, and he comes across as almost having kind of an unbalanced mind, that he was just like tyrannical, maybe even like a little bit manic. I mean, was he all there?
No. I mean, keep in mind what people were like in those days. You know, captains and admirals tended to be, you know, really tough SOBs. And they may have been admired, but mostly they wanted to be feared. You know, he had the power to torture, strangle, or execute people who were disobedient. It was, you know, the standards of behavior were almost non-existent by ours, you know, by our what we think of as being acceptable today. So Magellan was, you know, seen as a tough guy among other tough guys, and not really popular. You know, I think it's hard to get a sense of what his personality is like. With Columbus, you know, who had come just before him, you really do get a sense of, you know, what Columbus is like from his writing and what people said about him. With Magellan, I found it was much more difficult, and one has to infer, you know, what he was like. But you know, I would say his main approach was, how do I get from point A to point B, and how do I accomplish the mission, and how do I get back when it's done? So he was eminently practical. Oh, there was one other part of him. He did, like many people, have a religious side to him. Now, that's when, you know, you mentioned they're manic and they sound like they're, you know, really out there. Many people, especially sailors, but many people heard the voice of God talking to them, especially when they were in extremis. Now, today, when that happens, you know, they get diagnosed as being schizophrenic or hallucinating or God knows what. But in those days, in the Renaissance, they were simply having a religious experience. It wasn't considered abnormal. And, you know, Magellan was like that. Columbus was like that. So were many others. So Magellan had a kind of almost a messianic motivation about him, and he wanted to spread Christianity wherever he went. He was a very devout Christian, and he wanted to convert as many of the indigenous peoples he's encountered as possible, some of whom, by the way, were quite willing to be converted and were very impressed by Christianity. Others threw it off almost as soon as he was out of sight. It really depended. When he got to the Philippines, which was where he was killed, it really took root. And the Philippines, ever since Magellan's day, has been a major, if not the major, outpost of Christianity in the Pacific Ocean. But that's all directly due to Magellan, who was the first one to bring it. He had a couple of priests with him. He conducted mass almost daily on his ships. You know, they were very devout in and around all their, you know, cruelty and rough and ready ways.
I hear you. It does seem in your book about him, though, that as he's dying, it seems like his crew could have perhaps rescued him. It implies that maybe they let him die. Was that what happened?
Well, there's two theories. They could have saved him, yes. There is a theory that he had alienated them so much by that time that they would just as soon let him die when he was attacked by the tribesmen in the Philippines under the leadership of their leader, Lapu-Lapu. But he certainly had a lot of loyalists, including Pigafetta. And if he had kept his wits about him and not gotten lured into this battle, this fight, which he could not win, he would have survived. He certainly had the navigational skills to do it. He had gone that far, and he had crossed the Strait of Magellan. He was the first European who ever did that, so far as we know. That was an incredible feat. And there were others that he accomplished. So he certainly had the sailing skills. But he could get very cranky. Now, it's possible by that point in the voyage, late in the voyage, he was beginning to suffer from some deficiency from food or vitamins or something that affected his behavior. So he wasn't, you know, so to speak, thinking straight when this occurred, because what happened was he thought, well, he could easily defend himself against the Filipinos, because he had guns, which they didn't have, and armor, which they didn't have. They only had fire-hardened spears. But there were 1,000 or more of them and only a dozen of Magellan and his men. So the, you know, eventually that overwhelming number of the Filipino warriors did him in, and there's a very graphic account which Pigafetta, who was there, left of his effectively being slaughtered by the Filipinos. What's so bitterly ironic about this is that when he first arrived there a few weeks earlier, he had been given an enthusiastic greeting, and they'd been happy to see him, and he had started converting them to Christianity, which really stuck long after this bitter, you know, episode passed. So, you know, I guess you could say that he blew it, but, you know, it's easy to say if you're not there. But he wasn't the only captain who was like that. Captain James Cook, who came in the 18th century, so this was more than 200 years later, was also killed when he was circumnavigating the world. And so, he, you know, Magellan wasn't the only one. Others did survive. Not everybody was killed.
And I've got to mention, I mean, your books are wonderful, and these are really fascinating subjects. But, of course, these figures are definitely somewhat reviled these days, particularly, you know, people like Christopher Columbus, who did terrible things. What are your feelings about these characters as you're writing about them?
Well, you know, when I grew up, you know, Columbus Day was considered a given, like Washington's birthday, and, you know, that has gradually changed, and you're right, he is reviled, and I live in New York City. There's been a movement for several years to take down the famous statue of Columbus that's in Columbus Circle, to change the Columbus Day parade into what they now would call Indigenous Day or Indigenous People's Day Parade, and I think that's actually happened in some cities. You know, keep in mind that, you know, across America, there are, you know, the name Columbus pops up so often, not just in New York. There's a Columbus, Ohio. There are so many Columbus Avenues, Columbus Streets, and, you know, landmarks and buildings and institutions, and you name it, that are named after Columbus. It would be almost impossible to eradicate from you know, a life in the United States. And, of course, the irony there is not only did he never set foot in North America, he never even knew it existed. He never got far enough north. He was always in the Caribbean and Central America, and that's all he knew. So I think he would have been flabbergasted if he came back today. There was this enormous continent, which was the most prosperous part of the world, and there were so many landmarks named after him. He just would have been scratching his head and wondering, how did this happen? And, you know, the part of the way that reason that it happened was that credit for exploring or discovering the New World was given to him by others at that time. So, you know, although his reputation, even in his own day, wasn't that great. He was considered rather brutal. As time went on, he was held responsible for the genocide of millions of indigenous people, the Taino and other tribesmen in Central America. And it almost sounds as if Columbus, you know, came to the New World on a mission to slaughter all these people. However, it really wasn't that way. He was actually looking for China. Didn't know the New World existed, although after several voyages he had to concede that it did, thought that the indigenous peoples whom he encountered weren't Indians, you know, from American-style Indians, but were actually Chinese, that they were Asian. So he was hopelessly confused about where he was and what he was doing. It's kind of remarkable to think that. And the old, you know, he made four voyages. As time went on, he became more and more delusional. By the time of the fourth voyage, third or fourth voyage, he thought when he was sailing north of Venezuela that he could sail uphill and he could see the entrance to heaven. And he heard the voice of God, you know, more than once. So there was a visionary side of Columbus that was uprooted from reality, which was guiding him along. He also embarked on mass conversions to Christianity. He didn't realize that his mere appearance in the New World would trigger all the chaos that it did, because the indigenous people in the New World, when they saw him, took the arrival of his ships as a fulfillment of a prophecy. Okay, but then his men started having orgies or mating with the local women, and that did not go over well with the indigenous people, who felt that their future was being supplanted by this new breed, if you will, of person, which was, you know, half part European and part American. Their reaction was to think that their future was taken away, and they started jumping off of cliffs and eating poison grass and committing suicide by the hundreds of thousands. And Columbus was flabbergasted. He could not understand why this was happening, and he was just, you know, completely amazed and bewildered by it. So it wasn't like he went out with a bunch of soldiers and, you know, had mass executions and shot people. It was inadvertently tragic, and really tragic consequences of his arrival here. This is not to say that Columbus was a great humanitarian. He really wasn't, because even though if he encountered these indigenous people, he was supposed to convert them to Christianity. You can see in his own writing that he suddenly started thinking about them as potential slaves. And how much material could they carry? What kind of menial chores or labor could they perform for Europeans? So he had a kind of double vision of what they might be like. Columbus was a very complicated character, and you could say he's a idealist gone mad or something. I think it's in a way more complicated than Magellan.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think Magellan was really just, you know, he had a job to do. He was trying to sail around the world, get the spices and go back. And, you know, he didn't really philosophize too much about what he was doing. And I think his opinion about things remained fixed. Columbus, you can see him over. Also, he was on four voyages, although they were shorter. You could see that he deteriorated, evolved and deteriorated during that time. Also, he went with his brother, who was an important factor, often forgotten now, who was, in a way, encouraged some of his worst instincts in terms of brutality towards the indigenous people. Some of the effects of the voyage did not become apparent for a long time. For example, you know, you wonder, after Magellan circumnavigated the world, well, what was different and how did things change? And you can say, well, not that much. It was an incredible feat, and he brought back all this, all these spices, and, you know, he helped make Spain, you know, a bit richer than they had been before, and they had bragging rights. Columbus actually triggered something that was identified by a modern scholar called the Columbian Exchange. And that was completely unintentional. Columbus brought with him things that he didn't even know existed, like germs, which also killed millions of indigenous people in the New World. Again, he never intended. He didn't say, oh, I'm going to go there and I'm going to have the flu, and those indigenous people are going to catch it and die, and that's going to be the way I'll get rid. You know, nobody knew what germs were like. It was the farthest he could not conceive of that. But the Columbian Exchange also involved various kinds of livestock. There were no horses in the New World until Columbus brought them over. Of course, they became a very important part of American Indian life. But that also applied to many other animals. And the same thing with different kinds of crops. There were no tomatoes in Italy until Columbus brought them back from the New World. So that meant no tomato sauce. And so many things that we consider, you know, to be staples of Italian cooking or American cooking or something were actually, you know, brought to one place or another by this Columbian exchange. And another important part of it was tobacco, which became a very important kind of cash crop. Columbus saw the indigenous people smoking the tobacco, which seems like it might have been stronger than, you know, normal tobacco leaves today, and maybe more like marijuana, but I'm just guessing, that's speculation. But in any case, you know, was intrigued by it and brought it back, and that also had an important, played an important role in the expansion of Europe in the New World. So Columbus, you know, he's just really interesting on different levels, you know what I mean? And he had a fascinating kind of psyche, but yeah, he is really unpopular. Each Columbus Day, I'm wondering if it'll be the last, because the holiday, as you probably know, is relatively new. It was started in, I think, 1932 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because he wanted to make a play for the Italian vote. And there had been, sort of spontaneous Columbus Day parades in various cities with significant Italian-American populations. So he decided to make it into an official, a federal holiday. And so the parades, you know, became more of an institution than ever. And that way he would, you know, lock in or at least capture a significant part of the Italian vote, which was what happened. So that was smart politics on Columbus's, on FDR's part. So that's how we wound up with Columbus Day. But of course it could also be undone just as easily if the right set of circumstances came along. Personally, I'm of two minds about it, but you know, I don't really know what to think. I think Columbus was, you know, the destructive effects can't be dismissed because they were so huge. On the other hand, you can't erase him from history because the implications of his voyage were enormous, and you can't reverse it. You can't pretend it didn't exist, and so you need to know about it, you know, in all its ambition and horror and everything else, because it's so important.
Right, and to know it is not the same as to honor it, let's say.
Exactly. Good point. To know it doesn't mean to honor it, but it means to understand it, which is a lot different. For example, Marco Polo, he went all the way to China and back, and he wrote about it, but it made no difference. It had no effect on China, no effect on Venice, where he was from. The only thing that mattered was that he, when he got back, dictated an account about his voyage, his trip. So that mattered, but, you know, it was entirely different.
Right, and on Marco Polo, you know, as a historian, a lot of the primary source material for his journey is just based on his journal. I mean, what was your process like for evaluating the claims he made?
Yes, and he wasn't even the only one who wrote about it. He wrote the longest, most complete account that survived. Keep in mind, it was pre-Gutenberg, so the number of documents that survived, because they were just handwritten before then, is very small, and there may have been others that were lost. You know, so there are a few, but they are, you know, pretty slim compared to Marco Polo's account. And there are also accounts that are from Eastern sources going along the Silk Road, which was not called the Silk Road in those days, showing it what it was like from their perspective. Sometimes at a very, you know, within months of Marco Polo, you could, or a few years, so you could compare, you know, city by city or place by place, what had happened in the intervening period of time. Were things getting better, you know, conditions getting better in a certain city, or conditions getting worse? And one Marco Polo in reverse, as I call him in particular, was named Rabban Soma, who was a Manchurian monk. He was an Eastern Christian who was, while Marco Polo was making his way east, he was heading west because he wanted to go to Rome to see the Pope and try and link up these two disconnected branches of the church. the Roman branch and the Eastern Christian or Orthodox part of it. And he wrote an account as well. It's not as interesting as Marco Polo, but it's very interesting. But they were not, you know, Marco Polo was not out to, he was interested in trading with the Mongols who ruled China, especially with Kublai Khan. So he was not, you know, they were not warriors. They were not looking to kill people. They didn't get involved in battles. They were merchants. They were traders.
And Polo is credited with opening up Asia to European trade, but as you point out in your book, the Mongol Empire played a huge role here as well. And I had talked to another historian, Jack Weatherford, about Genghis Khan, and he did a pretty good job of persuading me that the Mongols, while they were obviously, you know, brutal, they were really maligned as these barbarians in just like a very like sort of, not sort of, it was like an anti-Asian racist way in the European imagination. In what sense did the Mongols differ from their reputation, and why were the Polos like willing to meet with them?
Well, I think the Mongols were fairly successful, sophisticated, fabulous horsemen, and with very few people managed to rule Mongolia, which is a huge area. And so, you know, the steppe, and they had all sorts of ways of doing this, and, you know, couriers, and they developed a kind of a sign language. They had an early form of money, and they had their own language. They had their own literature. So I think Mongol civilization or Mongol culture is sophisticated and very interesting. I don't think they would be considered particularly, you know, barbaric. And you can make a case that Europeans in some ways were more violent or, quote, barbaric, unquote, than the Mongols. Marco was a, you know, and his, because he traveled with his father and uncle, were quickly taken in by them and traveled with them. And the Mongols often used foreigners as tax collectors, because they were an army of occupation. They were occupying China. And if they used foreigners or outsiders to collect taxes because they were neutral and they didn't trust the Chinese to do it. They didn't trust even other Mongols to do it particularly. So other Europeans, you know, did the same thing as the Polo family. And that's how they earned their keep while they were there. And then, you know, when they went on the return trip, they sewed as many gems, rubies and other things into their garments as they possibly could. And you know, keep in mind they weren't using paper money or anything at that point. And that was the source of their wealth, which, you know, if they succeeded, made them fabulously wealthy by the time they got back home. Although, you know, it was a trip of several years.
So what originally persuaded them to go on this trip along the Silk Road?
No, he went along as a kid with his father and brother. And it was their second trip to China. We don't know anything at all, as far as I know, about their first trip. And when Marco went, he went as a teenager and then came back as a man. So he grew up on the road, if you will. So when he got back to Venice, you know, which he hadn't seen in well over 20 years, he was seeing it with entirely new eyes. And it took him a while to adapt to, you know, what was, you know, his native city in which he, you know, sort of didn't belong.
You've written about all these different explorers. Do you see any common threads in their psychology? Like, in other words, what drives these people to trek all the way across the world? Is there something that they all have in common?
Well, I don't know. I tend to focus on the differences. You know, I see Columbus and Magellan as being quite different. I see Marco Polo, and even though they're all Latin, and I see Marco Polo as being, you know, very different from any of them, because he was not at all, you know, warlike. But I'm sure they're all incredibly brave and tough, you know, and resourceful. So they have that in common. And often they were driven by, well, two things, you know, by gold and by God. So those are the two things they were going after. In Marco Polo, we don't really get a sense of he's, excuse me, motivated by religion. He's motivated by, you know, his, because it's a family, he's going along in the family business, and they're merchants, and that's what he's pursuing. I thought, and this is sort of just my own idea, as I read over and over in his travels, that he moved, because he was gone so long, that he moved away from the Christianity he knew as a young person in Venice towards a more Eastern, or if you will, Buddhist point of view when he got into China, because he was surrounded by other faiths, and especially Buddhism, and he begins to write about it, and with some understanding and appreciation. If Magellan encountered any other religion, he just considered it idolatry, period. Forget it. That's all. End of story. Marco Polo was more understanding or perceptive or sympathetic. And, you know, you can sense his perceptions evolving as time goes on. Now, what happened once he got back to Venice, we can only guess. But, you know, one thing that was interesting was that he didn't spend that much time there before he went out on a and got involved in a sea battle against Venice's big rival, which was Genoa, then was jailed for a while. That's when he dictated his memoirs that are the ones that survive. So in a sense, he was kind of a man without a country. But a lot of this is, you know, is inference. You know, it would be difficult to sort of nail down, you know, and say, you know, there's without a shadow of a doubt. And there's a lot of questions about the veracity of Marco Polo's text. When I was doing research for this book, I came across some versions of it that were literally twice as long as others. And, you know, as I said, he dictated it to a kind of a second-rate romance writer who was his cellmate, although I think it was a luxurious cell in Genoa, maybe more like house arrest than being in a prison. And so this guy wrote it down, and that's how we hear about it. Also, it wasn't in chronological form. When Pigafetta wrote his journal of Magellan's voyage, it's in Pigafetta, you know, it's in chronological form, you know, April, May, June, you know, various dates. Here's what they did on Christmas Day or on New Year's and Easter especially, which was the most important holiday in the calendar. But in Marco Polo's time, things were different. Keep in mind that they thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system, not the sun. And their idea of what was north or south might have been quite different from ours. He kept more of a descriptive account, a general summary of what he saw, rather than a day-by-day or week-by-week account of, you know, well, then we rolled into Beijing, and then we went in a, you know, it's not like that. It's sort of a kind of encyclopedic descriptions of various areas that he visited. And it's possible that he didn't even visit some of them himself, that he may have interviewed other people who went there and told him about it, and then he passed off their observations as his own. There is even a theory that he didn't go to China at all. There's a woman named Frances Wood who wrote a book about that, saying Marco Polo didn't go to China, that he stayed comfortably back at some outpost and just interviewed other travelers from China and wove together their accounts. That actually doesn't work because it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny, because he wrote too much about China to compile that way. And there are some extremely slender records in Chinese about the Polo family being in China, which would place them in China, just as he said. Nevertheless, it's really fascinating because, you know, we're kind of at the limits of, you know, how much we can know and, you know, the veracity of records at this point. And, you know, where is it fair to speculate and where is it fair to just say, you know what, this is just made up. There were bogus accounts of travels and voyages around the world that people took to be true, which have since been, you know, completely torpedoed, and, you know, now they're just seen as a kind of curiosities because people know they weren't true. But at that time, you know, they were jostling for credibility, and, you know, it often takes a while to sort these things out, and, you know, when they're happening all around you, you know, who can tell what's what?
And now, as we're sort of wrapping up here, I'm also curious, from your perspective, you've written about these people. What persuades you as a historian to spend, I mean, years of your life to studying these people?
I have a confession to make, and that is that I find history boring. And when I was in school, I found history boring. And the recitation of facts and, you know, the rote learning and a kind of a one version of the way things were, I just made my eyes glaze over. What I find interesting about history is that it's the actions of people in pursuit of their aims. And it's adventure. It's adventure stories. And it's a lot of conflict. It's, you know, I find it exciting. So for me, what makes history real are the primary sources, you know, the accounts of people who were actually there, whether it was Winston Churchill or Marco Polo, you know, who wrote about it. And, you know, that makes it, you know, for me, you know, come alive. And it's a fascinating, it's kind of an endless trove of stories all sorts of, you know, asides that you never imagined. And so that's why I like it. And that's why I find it so interesting. Also, I like going to the places when possible where, you know, it took place, either to do research or to see the sites. It's a real eye-opener, you know, to see if you go to Venice or you go somewhere in China, to see the places that the people have written about. And it makes all the difference. And so that's, you know, that's for me is what is what's exciting about it. For me, it's a lot of thrills. And but that's because it's out of the classroom.
Wonderful. Lawrence, on that note, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Good talking with you.
Thank you to Lawrence Berggren, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.